case, which is case number 50603, Cody Deedy versus State. We have the same litigants here, Mr. Logan and Mr. Barlow. Mr. Logan, tell us about this case.
Okay. And I hope I don't confuse some of the facts with each other, because I noticed I was doing that when I was preparing. But what happened in this particular case was he was charged with, he received two life sentences for touching the breasts of an underage girl. What the record reflects is that this girl, Jay, was her name. She was interviewed by the same police officer, Ms. Cowley. At first, she denied any improper things were happening. Then, on another occasion, the police officer said, "Well, he's just using you," and so she kind of changed her story a little bit. Then, on another occasion, she had to be reminded that she said there was bad things. So there were some questions as the interviews went on.
Mr. Logan, did the state at any time move to admit, do cross-admit the SC and JJ cases as under 48045 in each of the other trials?
I don't think so.
Okay. I mean, I'm just saying that usually, I guess, out of Clark County, that's what we see. It didn't happen.
I was wondering about that. There were some motions, and I was wondering about that, but then I went down there and nothing.
Well, at least it eliminates one potential appellate issue or something like that. Okay.
So what? First problem, and it's again where the police officer is allowed to reiterate the testimony of the victim and somehow bolster it. That's the first problem. Oh, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes too. And we've pretty much gone through that. That's the same kind of an issue
and the bolstering, again, it wasn't objected to in this case either.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't. But still, you know, there's a lot of case law on it that you know, you can't keep, you know, we call it bolstering here, but there's stuff all over. Like, it's when... you have, when somebody tries to load up on the evidence and they say it's cumulative and stuff, you know, and you make an objection because you have something that you're proven, but you're trying to, you know, you're trying to bolster it through saying it over and over and over again, and that's what's going on here. The next thing is that, you know, there was vouching going on with the investigator again. When she was asked, she said, well, when she was asked about the little girl changing her story and stuff, and she said, well, you know, victims like this, they try to protect the perpetrator. Sometimes they're afraid they'll get in trouble, and so they sometimes say these things. And so she was allowed both, you know, to vouch for the truthfulness of this little girl.
From the record, Callie did not opine about JJ's truthfulness.
Well,
did she? Yeah.
Not directly. But she explained why there's these discrepancies. And you know, when you say was she qualified? I think it was in this one. I think it was in this case where she talked about her qualifications. There were qualifications. She said she went down and she took some college. She took psychology 101 and a child psychology class. I mean, that's not. I took psychology 101 because that's what I had to do in college. But that doesn't make me qualified to opine on post-traumatic stress syndrome or things of that.
Yeah,
nature.
But you got to object though to it. I mean, anybody can testify to anything.
If you don't object, I got a higher standard. No. Absolutely. But I still have a standard. You know, I still have a standard. It's a big error. It's not only. It's clear. It's there. There's case law on it, and it's very, very damaging. And yes, well, but I have a higher standard. But it's my position that it's admitted.
The other problem is that you know,
the prosecutor kind of did a couple things in his opening and closing argument. You could be classified as misconduct. They kind of lap over. But one of the things that he says in his opening is that, you know, he's saying this is something that the state has the burden of doing, protecting citizens, the children of this community, and that's why we are here today. Thank you very much. When he says we are here, he means we the prosecutor and we the jury are here to protect these children. Then in his closing argument, he talks about how Mr. Gamond accused the girl of lying, and he says, well, we both said it, and it's true. These crimes don't occur out in public. You don't invite spectators. These are secret crimes. And our laws in this state protect children, and we are not going to listen. And if we are not going to listen to the children, if we are not going to listen and take action on what they say, we might as well get rid of these laws because it becomes fair game. What he's saying is he's telling them, you got to join with me to protect our children, and you got to listen, and you got to take what these children say. Otherwise, they're going to be fair game.
Wasn't he commenting on the evidence, though, like that of whatever was presented at the trial?
That's a comment on the evidence. To say that we have to, we have. Yes.
Well, he was commenting about the children's testimony, and all. Correct me if I'm wrong, but when that came up, you know.
Well, yeah, he's commenting on her testimony. Yeah, he's saying, but he's telling him, you got to listen to him, otherwise we might not even have.
Was that objected to, that argument?
No.
Okay.
But by the same token, we got a lot of stuff that says you can't impassion and play in the jury with your arguments. I cited a case by Justice Hardesty.
Valdez.
Yeah, it was a civil case, but it really was great.
Oh, Leachy versus Cohen.
Cohen, yeah, but it's really great because it says, you know, when you start referring to things other than the facts, you start question. You know, it starts getting out of hand. What were in the courtroom for?
Did you cite to Justice Cherry's dissent,
yeah,
Valdez?
Did.
You know,
well, I don't know about Valdez. I don't know why. Does it go back on it? but it, you know, that's. You know, the whole idea is, I mean, there's a lot of theatrics going on in the courtroom. You know, that happens. But they're really not supposed to. Because what we're doing is we're taking facts and we're trying to convict somebody. And those facts either show they're guilty or they don't. And all this extraneous stuff, all these theatrics, don't go to that. It goes to whether a lawyer is a good actor. But it doesn't go to the truth of the matter. And that's what we're trying to get to. And in this case, you had a little girl who first she said nothing happened, then she said something did, and then there were some letters that came in that maybe showed that there was a relationship going on between the two of them. You know, she apparently wanted to go farther than he was willing to go because of her age. And she testified to that. That was somewhere in the transcript.
So the 22-year-old man was restrained himself around the 13-year-old girl. Wanted to be more aggressive.
Well, that's what she wanted him to be more aggressive. That was in some of the stuff. And he said no. She was too young. I mean, I don't know if it's good or bad. You know, there was this relationship. I'm stuck with that. Or that seems clear, you know, nobody rebuts it. The question is, how far did it go? You know, you had these problems that occurred during the closing argument where there came a big to-do over whether or not he admitted to actually touching her. And you had, it was kind of strange, you know. She asked him. The investigator asked him, "Did you touch her breasts under her clothes?" And he says, "No." And then she says, "Did you touch her? Did you touch her over her clothes?" And he says, "Yes," which that obviously occurred. And she had her hand and she put her hand on her breast. And then she interpreted that as being a question of did you touch her breast on the outside.
Well, ultimately, that'd be a jury issue, wouldn't it, about...
Sure, it was. But during the argument, he said he admitted to touching her on the outside of her breast, and he didn't. He never did that. He touched her outside.
And you argued he didn't admit to that, you know, like that.
No, he didn't. He didn't admit to that, yeah. And not specifically, no. I guess you can argue whatever, but even the investigator ultimately said that, you know, he didn't specifically admit to anything like that. And the other fact's not in evidence that he talked about was supplying things to the little girl. That was never in the record. So I was referring to facts outside. So in any event, are there any questions that
you want to reserve the other four and a half minutes?
Yeah, sure, I would. I just okay.
Carlo, for the state.
I might help the court on the prior question. Our appendix and papers do not show the jury instructions on what I call TD1. This case we're arguing now is TD2. It's a practice in our district. The judges, that is a stock instruction, as Justice Gibbons pointed out. However, they always bring up it's their defense choice. If the defense chooses not to take the stand, they are given that choice. And normally, if they do take the stand, that instruction is withdrawn. It has been my experience. But we do have Mr. Gallman, who was trial counsel for the defendant, with us today, so we can maybe find that out a little later. This is TD2. I think it's first significant for me to point out to the court, TD2 followed TD1 by about 6 weeks, I think. About 6 weeks in time. Justice Gibbons, we did not try to seek to cross-enter. I felt that would be an unfortunate way to deal the case, and it would only serve to confuse and cloud up the issues. So we did not seek to cross-enter the first case into the second, and I recognize the appellate issue that creates.
You've been reading Justice Cherry's opinions, I think.
I'm probably a D.A. Bravo.
I appreciate Justice Cherry's decisions.
I'm going to have you teach the course on prior bad acts to the other judges in the state.
But I have to tell you that I would think that would be inappropriate. Mm-hmm. These were two different defendants. If it had been the same defendant, perhaps maybe I'd have wanted to do it all at once. But it was a different victim and should stand on its own and did not require that sort of action. It's interesting to listen to the defense, and I'll speak first to his argument as to Officer Cowley's bolstering. Again, this kind of crosses over from TD1 and just kind of continuation on. But I point out that this happened 6 weeks later. Again, there were no motions in limine. There were no challenges to the qualifications of Mrs. Cowley as an expert. She was duly admitted. There were no objections made at trial. So this is the scene as we come into TD2. The witnesses in TD2, except for the victim, which is a different victim, are the same. It's Officer Cowley, a different victim. There's no differences. So not only did the defense have notice from TD1 of what the content, because they had Officer Cowley's notes, interviews, and statements. They had another 6 weeks to sit on it, chew on it, and decide what they wanted to do before they went into trial in TD2. And so they were fully aware, fully capable, and I can only say it must have been their strategy to do the same thing, and that is to deny and accuse, and that's what they did. Now, Officer Cowley was duly admitted, noticed as an expert in this case, and what I gather from the appellant's argument on this issue is that they feel that they would be able to set out what the state can do in terms of argument and case, that the defense gets to decide what happens. And I don't think that's the case. We have to provide a full and complete picture and relevant and allowable evidence, and that's what we did in this case. Being duly admitted as an expert by the court, Officer Cowley, And I the appellant has her CV. They know her training and experience. Over 25 years in doing this sort of thing. It's significant. I think over 260 hours of training through national organizations and recognized experts. But when we bring an expert in, the expert, part of their obligation in presenting to the trier of fact is, yes, I have an opinion. Here's the opinion. But they have to explain why they have this opinion under the facts of the case before them. Now, here's what I did. Here's what I saw. Here's what I heard. Based upon that, I have this opinion. And this is the testimony that Officer Cowley gave. The appellant would denigrate or have you ignore the fact of her testimony as an expert in this field and simply wave her off as, well, you know, she's just bolstering, confirming. Again, this fits in the same situation on 50.035 on our evidence code. The victim was available at trial. She was the declarant. The defense, again, was attacking the motive and the truthfulness of the victim. Fits within 50.035 very tightly and subsequently is allowable. Now, and with all due respect to Mr. Logan, and I realize he's not personally going after me, nevertheless, to allege misconduct is a personal item. I kind of take it that way. And all I'm hearing is his opinion of, I think that the words that were spoken mean this. And that's not where we're at. He takes me to task in my argument for saying we need to listen to the children. We do. This was a child victim. This was a case where the defense argued fabrication, lies, untruthfulness. They attacked the victim in that way and attacked their testimony. Based upon that, it's perfectly logical and a perfectly good argument to say we need to listen to the children, the victim. Again, these crimes, you know, this is not a spectator sport in most instances. These crimes are done in secret. They're done in back rooms. They're done out of the course of view of others, whether parents or family. And as such, the only actual witness we have becomes the child victim themselves. Lastly, to touch, and this is, sorry, pardon for the reference, the touching issue. The appellant's argument is that this is some sort of, I believe, other uncharged conduct. I'll double check that. Yes. And I think the court's aware. There were three original charges at trial. The jury acquitted Mr. Keady on one and found him guilty on two. They were a thinking jury and a considerate jury. The appellant's argument is that the testimony of the victim that had Mr. Teedy on a prior occasion tried to reach inside your blouse was improper, an allegation of another offense. I don't see how it can be. There were three charges. There was testimony of his groping and touching and trying to gain advantage on this young lady. And there's no specifics here as to time, as to place, and comes at the end of testimony can only be reasonably inferred, I believe, as a reference to conduct already testified to. But it certainly doesn't allege some other distinct act outside the scope of the prosecution. Now, having said that, Any questions?
Justice Ada, Justice Gibbons?
No.
Thank you, Ms. Brewer.
Thank you.
Mr. Logan, you have 4 minutes and 25 seconds.
Okay, just to address some of the points that he made. He talked about the training of, the investigator and everything. I don't want to disparage anybody, but, if she was that good, she wouldn't ask a question. She would have gotten an answer, a better answer than asking a question through partial, putting a hand on her breast and then asking a question and interpreting things like that. She'd have gotten, in any event, the allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, that's what we call it, but it's actually improper argument. And that's what, when you're talking about children, when you're talking about listening to children, we're supposed to listen to all witnesses. We don't give children any greater credibility than any witnesses. And when they start talking about children and protecting the children, I mean, there's nothing greater than the human instinct to protect a child. And people jump into rivers and die, trying to save children. And so when you start using, that's highly inflammatory kind of argument, and it's improper. The last thing that he talked about was, the references to another other charges, and it's not clear. I threw that in there, but if you look at the way he presented the case, and he presented it very good. He was very distinct. He had three charges that he was working with, and he was very careful to go over one charge, the first charge, and then he'd go on to the next one and the next one. If you look at the transcript, that's what he did, and he should have done it that way. But then all of a sudden to bring this up and say, "Oh, I was referring to another charge," the record speaks for itself, and the record's the record. And I'm not saying that there's a lot of intentional of bad things happening here, but the question becomes, what is the jury perceiving, and is it improperly influencing them in determining the guilt or innocence of this thing? And, there was a lot of stuff happened in both these cases, okay? There's stuff coming in, there weren't objections, there was all kinds of stuff coming in that shouldn't have come in, there was objections, there was all this stuff that we've gone over. And the upshot of this whole thing is this 20-year-old's got 5 life sentences. And is this a kind of a record that you can just pass over and leave it like it is? And with that, I'll just leave it to you. Thank you.
Thank you. This case will stand submitted. This panel will be in recess until 11:30 for our next.